A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, I'm Umineya and welcome to the Girl Chart podcast. During the series, I'll be joined by some amazing guests and hearing all about their brand of brown girl magic. As well as sharing stories and discussions with the South Asian twist, we'll be getting stuck into the chart and the chat. I'd love to hear from you, so please get in touch on Instagram at Girl Chart. Hi everybody, welcome back. Today I'm joined by Nisha Party, a BAFTA award-winning film producer who has worked on critically acclaimed films such as The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel and the BBC's The Boy with a Top Knot. She's also the lady responsible for bringing Harry Potter to the big screen. As well as producing much-loved films, Nisha also contributed to the success of international eyebrow brand Blink Brow Bar with the company's founder, her sister, Vinita Party. Today we're going to speak to Nisha about her experience working on seminal movies, diversity in film, and about the importance of finding your own path in a very competitive industry. Hi Nisha, welcome.
Hi. Very nice to be here.
I'm going to set the scene. We're at my house, and whenever we record at my house, the snacks are way better. So we've got some pakoras and samosas.
Really good pakoras, which you've made yourself.
Thank you. Thanks so much. My mum will be proud. So this is all going to help us to get stuck into the chat.
Great.
I'd like to talk to you about your time working at Blink Brow Bar with your sister, Vinita. I'm a fan. I'm in there every week. The struggle, the hairy struggle is real. What's been the biggest lesson and you learn building such a huge, successful brand?
Oh my God. I mean, I feel like I've learned so many lessons. I kind of went into that business slightly by accident. Mm-hmm. My sister had already set it up and I had just left paid employment and was starting up my own film business. Mm-hmm. So she asked me to join her, really to give her a hand. And 10 years later, I was still there kind of running the company with her, which was really good fun. And I think the biggest lesson really was that when I joined, there were a couple of brow bars and together we grew it to kind of 26. Mm. And also launched outside in New York. And so we went from working with a really small handful of girls who were like family, working in a, you know, with one desk in an estate agent's office, which was kind of our head office, to having a big head office in Marylebone with 150 girls working for us, all of whom were Indian. That was that was kind of one of the most exciting things, really, was that we really gave a chance to a lot of women who had never worked in central London before, who didn't mm-hmm. have much confidence, who often came from India, having had arranged marriages, and suddenly they were working in Selfridges, and their life had changed, and we'd really helped give them that. Yeah. And also the amount of people that we meet, the same with you, you know, I've met you for the first time today and you happen to go to Blink Brow Bar.
From the start, guys, from the very beginning.
Thank you. Yep. And it's amazing. You just go to parties or whatever and everyone's like, oh my God, you're Blink Brow Bar. I get my eyebrows done. It's amazing. Yeah. And just makes you feel great that you're able to make people's brows popular.
So on to your film career, which has been what you've been working on for the past few years.
Yeah.
You set up Party Productions, which is a production company.
Yeah.
Could you start by telling us what role a film producer plays in getting a film from a script to the big screen?
Yeah, I think most people have no idea what a producer does. And I think we're the kind of least famous of the people that work in film. No one's interested in producers, which I think is a good thing. but really, we're kind of a bit like the CEO of the film.
Yeah.
So it's my job to often find the idea for a film or find a book or read a newspaper article and then figure out how to make that idea into a film.
Mm.
So I will hire a writer. I will then need to go and find money to pay that writer. I will develop a script with whoever ends up writing it. Often working with studios or the BBC or whoever is funding it. And then if we're lucky enough that that script is good enough that it goes into production, then it's my job to find the money to make it happen, to do all the contracts, to hire the director, the cast, you know, be on set, make sure it's running smoothly, make sure we don't go over budget, deliver it to the BBC as they require. And then once it's actually filmed, the director will go off. And it will be my job to publicise it and do the marketing and make sure it's released in cinemas or on the television or whatever it may be. So you're the only person really that's there right from the start to the end. And, you know, I guess the nice thing is if a film wins the best Oscar, I always say it's the producer that goes up to get that award, which kind of says it all, really.
Why don't we hear more about film producers? Because you're the ones who are responsible for actually getting stuff made.
Yeah.
And actually it's pre-script. It's a nugget or an idea from yourself, which makes this huge, you know, box office success.
Yeah. I think it's because what's happened now, which is really awful, is that there's so many producers on a film often.
Okay.
When you look at the credits, you'll see, you know, often six exec producers and people have no idea who was the real producer that brought it to. A lot of people buy producing credits. So now if I'm trying to find money, I might get some rich guy saying, well, we'll give you 5 million, but I want a producer credit. So often you get producer credits from people that have just financed a film, but they've not really creatively produced it. And they'll sit alongside the creative producer. And so we know who's produced it, but when you're watching a movie, you don't really know.
The public wouldn't know.
The public wouldn't really know.
And I also see stars of films becoming exec producers.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes they're brilliant, but often it's just a vanity credit that actually, if you want our huge star to be in it, then you need to give them a producer credit. And that's sort of, and they're kind of bought and sold a little bit, and,
yeah,
and it's become a bit sullied, and it's a real shame, but it's just the way the industry is and there's not much I can do about it.
That's so fascinating. I didn't know. Your first producer role was on a film called Honour, which is about honour killings and tells the story of a British Pakistani couple who were trying to elope. Did your background as a British Asian influence how you told that story?
Yeah, completely. So just to rewind slightly, before I produced Honour and set up my production company, I was working in film for probably about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I really started out as an intern,
yeah,
for a film company and kind of worked my way up until I felt ready to set up a company. So when I produced Honour, when I set up my company, I was only looking for Asian stories. And the reason I set up my company really was, I felt growing up, and I'm sure you felt this, although you're a bit younger than me, you know, I was never watching stories about me. And if there were Asians on television, it was always pretty stereotypical Asians getting arranged marriages or driving a taxi. And I just felt like, actually, you know, I'm an intelligent middle-class Indian that's done quite well, and I never see myself on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many stories that we have to tell, and they're just not told very well when they are told. So I set it out as a kind of total mission that I was just going to make interesting Asian films and TV drama that felt original and compelling and thought-provoking, but also were commercial and weren't just for the Asian audience, but were for an international audience. And that's kind of stuck with me, and I'm still trying to do that.
Yeah, and I think also they're told authentically, because obviously,
yeah,
from your gaze as an Asian, British Asian, you can kind of unpick a lot of things that perhaps somebody who's not wouldn't be able to do.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting now, actually, because at the beginning when I was trying to make Asian stories, most people just thought no one's going to buy them. It wasn't cool. It was a real struggle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm still pretty much the only female Indian producer in London.
Yeah.
And now suddenly diversity has become this really cool thing. And so what I'm doing is suddenly of interest to people, which is brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But it also means that every British production company is now trying to hire all those Asian writers that I've been working with for years.
Snapping them up.
Who suddenly become really cool and,
yeah,
paying them much more money than I can. And they're all making shows. And you know, what I have on my side is that I can convince those writers that I'm Indian too and I get it and I can make this drama authentic.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of British producers out there that can't do that because they just don't understand the world in the way that I do.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that gives me a kind of USP. Really.
An edge.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly why Girl Chart came to be, is because I feel like we've moved on from the last time discussions were kind of had in the media about what it's like to be British and Asian.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're always trying to tell stories of just such a how diverse everybody is and all the different cool things that everyone's doing. It's just not arranged marriages, like you said. It's we've got new problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's funny because I have a lot of Indian female friends, and all of them so break the tradition of what an Asian woman should be.
Yeah.
You know, whether they're working in an industry that's really unusual, or, you know, they've become TV presenters or actors or directors, or, you know, they've married outside their world, or they're gay, or,
yeah.
And I just think, you know, that's my world. And you never see that on screen or in the media at all. And that's really what I want to kind of try and do. But Honor was a little bit different in that, you know, that was, God, probably about 8 years ago now. And no one had really made an Asian-British thriller. So at that point, I really wanted to tell that story. And I felt like no one had really told the story of an honor killing that in a slightly different way.
Mm-hmm.
Now I sort of look back and think, God, maybe, you know, that was actually also a bit of a stereotypical story that I probably wouldn't want to tell now. But at the time, it felt quite groundbreaking.
I'm sure lots of our listeners, as soon as I said Harry Potter, they're like, what? Let's talk more about that.
Yeah, that's the only thing anyone's ever interested in talking about.
As we mentioned in the intro, you're responsible for bringing, you know, those books to the big screen. Tell us how it all began.
So this was a while ago. I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
And it was one of my very first jobs in the industry. I was the assistant to a film producer called David Heyman,
mm-hmm.
who'd come over from LA, and he had a deal with Warner Brothers Studios. And it was our job to find books, scripts, ideas, writers that they would want to work mm-hmm. with. And a couple of years in, we really hadn't found that much, actually. We were kind of slightly struggling, and I think they were about to, you know, they were getting a little bored of us. And then one day, a unpublished manuscript came in from a woman called J.K. Rowling. None of us had heard of her. And her story was that, you know, she's just written this book. It's her first novel. She'd been writing it in a cafe. It was about to get published. So there was a publishing deal, but it hadn't been released yet. So there was absolutely no hype about the book. And at that point, no one was making children's films. It mm-hmm. just wasn't a cool thing. So David was really sceptical and was like, yeah, I don't really know if this is going to be good. Why don't you read it? And I would read all the stuff that he didn't want to read. So it sat on the shelf for a while. And then one day I took it home on the weekend. And normally I would take stuff home on the weekend and come back on Monday morning and just go, this is all really rubbish.
Toss it.
We're going to make any of this. And then I read Harry Potter literally in one sitting because it was so brilliant. And I came back on Monday, and it was the first time I think I was enthusiastic about something. So his ears pricked up and he was like, oh my God, you actually like something? And I told him the story and he was intrigued. And I then wrote a report and sent it off to Warner Brothers so that they would read it. And the rest was really history then. And then he, of course, read it and loved it too. And all the other production companies had received that book, and they were all, although they'll never admit it, they were all turning it down because they didn't see
what you
yeah
you
because
read
I think in
saw.
Hindsight yeah. It's so easy to look back and go, you know, how could you not think this was going to be a hit? But actually then there was no buzz about it. And so, but in my head, it was a film. As I read the book, I just saw it as a film in my head. And that's kind of why I thought
it would
work.
So you're kind of outside the box thinking, like also about children's films is the reason why you perhaps resonated with you.
Yeah, I think so. And also it was just brilliantly written, and it was such a magical story. I mean, I think she's an absolute genius. And it was a really amazing journey to have been on, because, you know, our deal was sort of about to come up with Warner Brothers, and we were all thinking, oh my God. And then suddenly the fortunes turned, and, you know, 2 months later we had kind of Steven Spielberg on the phone saying that he wanted to direct it. And, you know, we were doing the casting process and I worked on the first film, and that was all really, you know, it's just really good fun.
So surreal, and one of the best stories I've ever heard. That is brilliant, brilliant. So you worked on The Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah.
Have you got like a key memory or a best memory of your time working there, other than that one that you just told us, which is pretty incredible?
I don't know if there was a... I mean, there were lots of really great little stories. And I think, you know, working with... I mean, I just remember working with kind of Emma and Daniel or meeting them for the first time. And, you know, there were all these, you know, really sort of naive, innocent, lovely little kids. And they're still all really lovely, actually. But just kind of watching it grow and become... You know, when we optioned the book, I mean, you know, no one had any idea what was coming. And so we all just... did our job and did what, you know, what we thought was good. And David did an amazing job as the producer of kind of making, because a lot of producers might have just not hired the right director or just not cast it well. And one of Joe's big things was that, because the studio was quite interested in it becoming an American thing, obviously. And Joe was adamant that it was to be British and that the cast were to be British. And that was one of the best decisions that everyone made together was, you know, it kept it here. Yeah. Rather than become a kind of precocious American teen, which, you know, could have happened quite easily.
Another in the wrong American hands. Kids film.
Yeah.
It's so part of British culture now, Harry Potter, and how many kind of tourists come as well. And yeah, it's a huge thing.
I know, and like Harry Potter World is now this big thing. And when you enter Harry Potter World, before you enter the world, you get given this, you get locked in a room and you have to watch the video of how the book became a film. I appear on the video and kind of tell my story. And so I get messages on Facebook from all these friends, literally, I haven't seen for 30 years that I went to school with, who are like, I've just taken my kids to see Harry Potter and you're in it. So I'm like, yeah.
That is so cool.
So it's just one of these stories that follows me around. But, you know, really, I was just doing my job. I read a book and I thought it was really good. But yeah, it's a good story to tell.
That is amazing. I love that story. There's no doubt that the movies are much loved and cherished by fans, like from all different backgrounds. But what are your thoughts about the criticisms of the films that they could have had more representation in terms of diversity?
Look, I completely agree. And I've definitely mentioned it to David a couple of times. Yeah. But unfortunately, I was just a small pipsqueak in that very big, you know, machine then. And so I just didn't have the power or control to be able to change any of that, which is why I'm making the films that I'm making. And I think what's really interesting is that if Harry Potter was made now, I think it would be so much more diverse. I think it was made at a time when actually there just wasn't much awareness, there wasn't much need for it, there was no public demand for it, and all of that's changing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's a total shame. I mean, it's a completely white movie.
I think you're right. It is about the timings that even however long ago that was, even though it doesn't feel that long ago, things have changed so much. Discussions, especially in terms of film sets and cast and crew. It's very different what the focus is on now, which is it's a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So talking about diversity in films, you said about your time producing Boy with a Top Knot that it was the brownest BBC production, both in front and behind the camera. How did you go about achieving it, and why was it so important for this particular film that you did that?
Well, for me, when it got greenlit into production, which was amazing, because really it was the first time that I felt the BBC had taken a risk on a drama that had a completely Asian cast, really, apart from one character, and wasn't something that anyone had really seen before. And so I felt a huge sense of responsibility that, A, this had to be really good, because if we didn't make it good, the BBC would just probably go, well, you know, well, we tried to make an Asian drama, no one watched it. It's a really good excuse to not make another one. So I felt like people needed to watch it, and also, you know, it needed to get good reviews and win awards. And for me, the most important thing was how to make it feel completely authentic. And it was a really tough job, because ideally I would have hired an Asian writer and an Asian director, but I really struggled, because I also wanted to hire someone who was a really good writer, who was able to tell that story well, adapt it from the book, and a brilliant director. And I struggled with finding Indian directors that really came to me with a brilliant point of view. And I met pretty much all the Indian directors out here. And I just ended up hiring an English, a Scottish director, actually. And the reason that I hired her was because I just felt like she came to it with a completely different vision. But as a result, it meant that I felt I had to be on set every day and be the kind of brown eyes and ears. Yeah. And also, I was in the casting process, so I really wanted to make sure, for example, that, because I see this so much on TV, that the Punjabi family were Punjabi.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a sort of, you know, an Arab son and a Muslim, you know, Pakistani child and a Sri Lankan father, and a, just because they're all brown, they all look like they're a family. Because I can tell.
They just don't. No.
So that was really important, just to have as many Punjabis on set as possible. It was really important to me to hire the parents who were Indian as opposed to English Indian.
Because
what happens a lot, again, I think, in drama is that English Asian actors are hired and then they have to put on an Indian accent.
And
that just, you can just see through it. That was one thing that I was really, 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 it was really important to me. And then in terms of hiring the crew, again, really hard to find heads of department who are Asian in this country. They don't exist. You don't find makeup designers or production designers or DOPs. They're just not at that level yet.
Yeah.
So what I did when I hired all the HODs was to say to them, you're going to get this job, but part of your job spec is that you have to have an Indian person on your team. And all of them went, oh, I just don't know any. I mean, I'm not going to be able to find any. And I really want to work with the team that I always work with. And I was like, that's the part, you know, that's the deal. If you take this job, that's the deal. So all of them very, you know, huffed and puffed, but reluctantly went off to find someone. And I often would help them and, you know, ask around, does anybody know any makeup artists who are Indian? And, you know, we had to, I mean, our makeup artist that we found who was Indian, he was in Bristol, and we had to bring her up from Bristol to Birmingham because we could only find one that was available.
Mm.
Really tough. But every single department had an Indian working in it. And so it felt like the cast weren't looking out at a crew that was completely white. And I think it made them feel at home. And it just meant there were observations from every department of, and it just felt like we were a bit of a family. So there were, you know, there were obviously lots of non-Indians working on that as well who were brilliant. But it just felt like, actually, in terms of finding, you know, cast and crew, it was the brownest drama that I think the BBC have ever made. And I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, I think that's so incredible at the lengths of the producer that you went to hire the people that you connected and clicked with, but also to make sure that there was the representation on set.
Yeah.
And it wasn't easy to do, but there are ways around it. And so I'm sure on bigger productions where there's even bigger budgets, there is a way of doing it. And so just to say there's nobody available doesn't ever really feel like a reasonable enough or believable
excuse. No, it's
tough
because, you know, I have to admit there were some sort of more junior members that I did hire on a bit of a punt just because they were Asian and they were really rubbish. And, you know, you do think, oh, you know, I know there are people going, oh, you know, I've only been hired because a bit like, you know, he's only hired because he's the boss's son.
Yeah, positive discrimination.
Yeah. And so, you know, you do have to be careful because, you know, and I would never work with those people again because they weren't very good at their jobs, but I gave them a chance. So, you know, you've got to be Asian, but you've also got to be really, really good if you're going to get somewhere.
So let's not just all start contacting Nisha for a gig.
Exactly.
Really want to touch on, why do you think still there aren't enough senior kind of makeup artists or set designers or other producers? Because I think a lot now we're third generation.
Yeah.
Why is it that people are still not going into those industries?
Well, I'm older than you, so I'm second generation.
But I'm still, am I second? I don't know. I am second. But okay, then, you know, the ones who are younger than us, they're at working age now, which is depressing.
And I think it's really changing amongst third generation.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I was at school and figuring out what to do, like every other Indian, I applied to medical school. I wanted to be a doctor.
Yeah.
Actually, no, not through any parental pressure, to just praise my parents for this. I really genuinely wanted to become a doctor, and the only reason I didn't was that I got a D in my physics A level, and I was so desperate to move out of the house and go and have some fun because my parents were quite strict.
Yeah,
that I just thought, I'm just going to go to university and do anything I can possibly do.
The gateway to fun, university.
Yeah, so yeah. I went to uni and I just did a science degree, random science degree. I found it so boring that I ended up directing, producing plays and, you know, doing other things.
Oh,
and
wow.
Thought, oh, actually, this is kind of fun. Maybe I should do this. And then I went to film school, and that's what how that happened. But, you know, Asians were, and they still are encouraged to have, you know, proper jobs. And proper jobs are accountants, you know, being an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor. And, you know, my parents still don't understand what I do. And when I have months of not really working in an office, when I'm developing scripts or coming up with ideas, they're like, you're not working, doing anything. What are you doing? And then, you know, there's 3 years between films and they're just like, why does it take so long?
Yeah.
So, you know, they're still really, I think they find it really difficult. And also, you know, growing up, I didn't know anyone that worked in the film industry. So, I mean, I literally, because we wrote letters back in those days.
Yeah,
I remember, you know, when I was at film school, I wrote like 100 letters to production companies to say, can I just come and work for free? And one person replied, and that was the agency that I ended up doing work experience in. And I arrived in that company, and probably 100 people there, and I was the only person of colour. And so, you know, I think I got accepted into that world because I speak like this. I went to a nice private school, and I know how to talk to and assimilate with nice middle-class English people. And so I settled in really easily and then kind of slowly worked my way up. But I never really saw anyone like me. And I think that's changing. And I think for third generation kids, they're now going, oh, actually, you know, there are a few Asian actors out there. And, you know, I think in terms of directing and writing, there's some really brilliant new talent coming up now, which, you know, even 5 years ago, I struggled to find. So it's a really exciting time.
It's definitely changing. Like my background's in television, and even on certain shows that I've worked in, like if I compare it to 10 years ago, the crew and the talent is definitely a lot more diverse. And I mean, that's an amazing thing. Obviously more work to be done.
Yeah.
And I also think networks help when you're going into these industries.
Of course.
But if you don't have a network, because obviously there might not be aunts and uncles who worked in the industry, I think just being tenacious and just really, you've got to, and I think in the media and film industry, you just have to keep those, like, letters are now emails, or they're now WhatsApps or DMs. They're just, you still need to keep plugging.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's an incredibly competitive, difficult industry to get into. And I think you only really want to get into it if you absolutely love it.
Yeah.
And, you know, whereas actually becoming a doctor or an accountant, there's a path and you go down that path. And, you know, it's not that it's not easy, but it's just, it's kind of slightly more formulaic. And
it's when you're, the path, yeah.
And when you're trying to get into media or writing or, you know, there's no rules. You just kind of have to make it work and carve your way through it. And that's tough for people who haven't seen how you do that. I think you've just got to have that fire in your belly. And there are amazing people that do that, but it's really hard, and it's been really hard. And I feel like actually I'm in my 40s now, but really, you know, it's taken me much longer than I thought it would take to get to this point. And obviously I was slightly waylaid because I started running Blink for quite a long time. But the only reason I started running Blink was because it was so impossible to earn a really decent living being a film producer, being an independent film producer, that I had to have a second job. So that's, you know, that's another hazard of what we do, is that there's just no regular income.
Yeah, and Asian parents don't like that.
And they don't like that at all.
They didn't get it. So we're going to talk about Boy with a Top Knot, which is a game changer in terms of being a film that talks openly about mental health, not just in British families, but also in particular South Asian families.
Yeah.
Can you explain briefly what the film's about?
Sure. Well, it's based on the biography of Satnam Singera, who's a very well-known journalist for The Times and also an absolutely brilliant, clever, funny writer and human being. And his story really, like many second generation Asians, I think, he got to a point in his life where he was slightly struggling with the person that he wanted to become and the person that his parents wanted him to become. And those were two different people. He was going out with a white girl. He was too afraid to tell his parents. And coincidentally, while he was struggling with this kind of internal battle, he discovered that his father had schizophrenia. And so he sort of goes on this journey to discover what schizophrenia really is and how his whole family have known about it for years, but no one really had talked about it. And so it's really kind of him coming to terms with who he is and who his family is. And I guess that's kind of, it's quite a complicated story, but I think that's probably the easiest way to sum it up.
I think you summed it up perfectly.
Okay. I mean, I remember just reading the book and falling in love with his writing and also the story and crying quite a few times throughout the process, probably because it resonated with me so much, you know, as a second generation Indian who feels immensely proud of where I've come from. And I love my parents, but I don't want to have their life. And I don't want to have the marriage that my mother's had, which is, you know, an arranged marriage with a man that she didn't love. And so I think most second generations completely relate to that struggle of respecting your parents and your culture, but actually forging a life for yourself. So that's what really resonated for me. But also it was so beautifully written. It's such a great story. And I just felt like no one had expressed it in the way that he has ever. And you know, I don't think there are that many good Asian writers out there yet. And it just completely touched me. So I had to fight quite hard to get that book. A lot of people wanted it.
Yeah, I bet.
So I wooed him.
and it paid off.
And it worked.
I totally agree. I think the film for me is so relatable, but what it did, which was amazing, was open up a conversation. So all the people I know who watched it, and I'm talking like my aunts and uncles' parents, opened up a very honest conversation about mental health, which needs to happen more.
Yeah.
But also it kind of named it, and instead of sweeping stuff under the carpet, it was actually something that you could name, if that makes sense.
And you know, I'm really proud of that, because I, you know, I'm sure we all grew up with a sort of uncle that was described as a bit funny or a bit strange, and actually, you know, they had mental health issues and they never had labels. They never went to the doctor. They were never put on medication. And, you know, I hope, certainly from the feedback that we've got from the film, I feel like it's, you know, a lot of people have gone, oh my gosh, well, I, you know, I've been through that and I really want to talk about it with my family. And it's, I mean, the response was overwhelming, which has been really lovely, but it just ups the game. So like the next one's got to be even better, which is kind of scary, but that's what I'm working on now, you know.
Again, it transcended, like, it wasn't just Asian families watching it and relating. Yeah. It was everybody.
Well, yeah,
watching.
I mean, we got consolidated kind of 3 million viewers on BBC Two, which was the highest rated drama that year on BBC Two. So it completely crossed over.
Yeah.
And that's really exciting. And also, you know, lots of Asians that only watch ZTV and watched BBC Two that night. And that's also really exciting.
Everyone was talking about it on my family's WhatsApp.
Good.
And also, the cast were incredible. But I have to ask about what it was like to work with the legend Anupam Kher.
Oh, he's amazing. Actually, both Deepthi and Anupam are amazing. And I grew up watching Deepthi in films, and I just remember how brilliant she was and totally forgotten.
Yeah.
So we resurrected her from, you know, she was painting in the Himalayas when we found her.
It's a good job if you can get it too.
And Anupam, I've always sort of been in touch with him for on and off over the years because I've always wanted to work with him. And we sent him the script and he loved it and happened to be, well, he made himself free. And then he got nominated for a BAFTA. So it's all very exciting, but he was an absolute gentleman.
Oh, I love him so much. Love Satnam as well. I'm always speaking to him on Twitter as well.
Right. Yeah, he's brilliant
on
Twitter.
Very funny on Twitter. Nisha, could you tell us what your latest project is?
I've got lots of quite exciting things on the horizon, but probably the most exciting thing to talk about is I'm working on a longer term series with BBC, which is about the partition of India, because it's a story that I feel has never really been told properly on film or TV from both the British perspective but also the Indian perspective of what really happened. What's really exciting is that Patrick Harbinson has just come on board to create that with me, and he is the man behind ER and 24 and Homeland. So he finishes Homeland this summer, and then he will start working on it with me. So we've got an amazing writer And then the plan is that we'll get a writer's room, which will be Indian and Pakistani writers to work underneath him, so that we have that kind of authenticity, and then we'll start writing the series. So that's my big thing that will take up the next year or two of my life, I think.
Oh, God, I'm so interested to watch that because, yeah. You know, we still have family members who talk about going through it. And
yeah.
I think as second or third generations, I don't think we really realise the impact of that and the transgenerational trauma, which we've talked about on the show before.
Yeah, and, you know, it's never taught in schools here, which I find insane because it's actually a part of British history. And when I speak to people about it, no one really knows what happened. And so I feel like it's a really important story to tell properly.
Amazing. Nisha, I could talk to you for hours. We've had to kind of just go through everything quite quickly, but what a fascinating insight into the film industry and into your career. It's been brilliant. So thank you. It's been great to meet you.
You too. Thank you for having me.
Thank you to our producer, Amanda. And
thank you, Amanda,
also
listening quietly next door.
And thank you, listeners, for listening and joining us again. Please comment on our Instagram and Twitter, which is @girlchart. And I will speak to you all really soon. Bye.